The first hearing we're going to, our first bill we'll hear today is we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2296. And call up Sergeant Duvall, Administrative Specialist Lindsay, and Kamala Sugar. You want to come up, please?
Mr. Chair, before the witnesses begin speaking, I did receive from Legislative Fiscal late yesterday a minimal expenditure impact statement. So if everyone would update their staff measure summaries to show minimal fiscal impact, please.
Thank you. Good morning. Just go ahead and whoever wants to kick off.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Before we get started, I just want you all to know this is my first appearance before a committee, so bear with me on any mistakes.
And you just need to identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Steve Duvall, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police here to represent the agency on Bill 2296. I do have written testimony.
Go ahead, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this bill, 2296, was intended to bring Oregon into compliance with the Federal Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act. Some of the requirements of the CSCPA include requiring in-state registered sex offenders to complete additional registration if they work at, attend, or carry on a vocation at an institution of higher learning. It also requires that this information be made available to law enforcement agencies with jurisdiction on the campus, and the institution must inform the campus population where to obtain the information on these registered offenders. Now, the current law for convicted or adjudicated sexual offenders regarding registration requires that they register within 10 days from release of confinement or when they're placed on probation, within 10 days of moving to a new address, within 10 days of their birthday on an annual basis, or within 10 days of moving to Oregon if they're required to register based on an out-of-state conviction. The additional registration that's covered by this bill is not required under current statute. The effects of the passage of this bill, it would require in-state residents of Oregon who are registered sex offenders to complete an additional registration if they work at, carry on a vocation, or attend an institution of higher education. It also requires that they must register within 10 days of any changes of status, such as school attendance or their work status. It also requires that the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit modify registration forms and the registry database to reflect a campus registration, which isn't currently captured. Doing that would allow the unit to track these specific registrations, and it would also enable a search for registrants at specific campuses, which we're not able to do currently. The estimated cost of changes to the database system would be $3,000 to $5,000. Once that information is collected, it would be made available to the local law enforcement agency with jurisdiction at the campus. Those agencies would then be in the position to provide the information to the institutions based on local agreements that would come up between those two entities. The impact on the total number of registrations across the state is estimated to be about 125 to 150. That represents a marginal increase for the sex offender unit, and it really does not affect current staffing. One of the purposes of this is to provide information for the public to protect themselves. As such, OSP supports the bill on the basis that it enhances public safety at the institutions of higher learning.
Okay, thank you.
And with me is Diana Lindsay of the Sex Offender Registration Unit. She and I will be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Duvall, the definition in the bill of an institution of higher education is a public or private educational institution that provides a program of post-secondary education. I'm sure what most people have in mind is a four-year college or a community college, but that strikes me as pretty broad. How would it impact on career schools or other kinds of training programs that people attend after they've completed a high school program?
Chair Barker, representing McPherson. I don't know that I can accurately answer that question. The CSCPA addresses institutions of higher learning, which is what Bill 2296 addresses. I can attempt to do some research on that and try to get an answer back to you.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair. Is this the same definition as the federal statutes that we're coming into compliance with, or is it a broader definition?
I believe it is in compliance with the federal statute, but I'm not 100% sure. Again, I'll have to do research on that and get the correct answer to you.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Ms. Sugar?
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kamala Sugar, for future
Sugar.
Reference. And it's phonetically spelled, I like to say. And I'm from Lane County, Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association and testifying in support of this bill. Well, we're not the proponents of the bill, and it's not one of our priorities. We do support it. And I wanted to just address a couple of points that weren't already addressed. We believe that the value of this bill outweighs the costs, which apparently are minimal. Campuses are a natural magnet for sex offenders. Coming from a campus town, I can tell you that many of the sex crimes I see committed by repeat sex offenders occur on our college campus. Having one of the largest higher educational institutions in the state, I think we have a pretty good sample. Young college freshmen who are naive to the warning signs and other things that others might notice about a sex offender who has signed up to live in the college dormitory because no one knows that they're a sex offender. This would simply provide notice to the institution, whether they've employed that person, whether that person is a volunteer, or whether that person is actually attending the school, either full or part-time. And it doesn't, and I think to slightly indicate a response to Representative McPherson's concern, this doesn't prevent registered persons from attending the school, working at the school, or volunteering at the school, perhaps to better themselves after a period of incarceration at a trade school. But what it does is provide notice to the institution and to the employer or the housing authorities so that they can make appropriate decisions regarding that person and inform other people who might need to know. So that's our position, and we support it, and we don't anticipate it being an extremely high cost to the state. Thank you.
Would that include, like I see as for Western Business College, would they have a short, fairly short courses to get somebody up to like a paralegal secretary or something? Would that include those kind of schools?
That I don't know. I would need to do some additional research, and I'm willing to do that if that the committee would like.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Further questions? Okay, we have two more people signed up. Lori Satinspiel and Lisa Zavala.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lori Satinspiel. I represent the Oregon Community College Association. We represent Oregon's 17 community colleges, which serve over 330,000 students. 53% of these are women. Protecting the safety of our students is paramount, and that's why I appreciate the opportunity to appear before your subcommittee this morning to testify in support of House Bill 2296. House Bill 2296 would adopt the provisions of the Federal Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act, which did pass in 2000. The bill would require the sex offenders to register when they enroll or become employed at the institutions of higher learning, including community colleges. OCCA supports the bill because it would allow the community college students and employees to access information about the sex offenders on campus. Sergeant Duvall mentioned the database is not searchable by campus, which makes it difficult for our students and employees. Under the existing law, administrators learn about sex offenders in haphazard ways, Sometimes the campus safety officers are notified by parole and probation officers or local law enforcement agencies. At times, the sex offender self-reports. But despite the federal law requirement, the post-secondary institutions provide information to students about where to find out information about sex offenders on campus. It's hard for our students to access the information for us to help them. This bill would change that. I would like to mention an issue that's been discussed by the Community College Student Services Directors, which relates to what happens with the information once it's available to the campus community. There's a concern about the potential increase of liability the colleges might face as a consequence of having this information. This is an issue that needs to be discussed in greater detail, as we have an obligation to ensure the safety of our students and visitors to the campuses. We don't have the resources to police the sex offenders on campus. We don't believe that the provisions in House Bill 2296 increase the liability, but do believe that's an issue that should be discussed and addressed in the future. We urge you to pass the legislation and look forward to working with you on implementing the federal law in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Okay. Please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Zavala. I'm the Senior Associate Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System. Here today to indicate that the State Board of Higher Education and the university system supports passage of House Bill 2296. I really don't have much more to add that's already been said. We would support this because it does, in fact, mimic the federal law, which we are under obligation to comply with. And we do support expanding this to include workers or individuals who carry on vocation on our campuses. Not much more to add.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move, close the public hearing and move into a work session. Entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2296 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. By way of comment, I did ask a question that I'd like to get a follow-up response to, but I don't think that should hold up our action on the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Okay, well, motion passes in the carrier. Representative McPherson, we'd like to carry that. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to start. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2015. And I have Speaker Minnis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Karen Minnis, Speaker of the House, representing House District 49. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2015. House Bill 2015 will give law enforcement a needed tool to go after criminals who commit sex crimes against our most vulnerable citizens, our children. I gladly introduce this bill at the request of Garrett Dell, a Portland police officer, who I believe is here today to testify on this bill. What House Bill 2015 does is extend the time for prosecuting sex crimes where the victim was under 18 years of age. House Bill 2015 simply increases time to prosecute a crime until the victim turns 30 years of age. Current law is 24 years old, or within 12 years after the offense is reported to a law enforcement agency or other governmental agency, whichever comes first. House Bill 2015 goes a long way to help victims. It helps people who have suffered sexual abuse to cope with these awful, traumatic experiences where they were subjected to as children. We shouldn't be letting people go free just because of a timeline. A date has expired, so somehow the law is they get to go free. Children that go through these experiences suffer lifelong consequences for an adult's behavior. I encourage this committee to push out the time frames to allow prosecutors more time to go after the criminals who committed unspeakable crimes against our children. Crimes like rape, sodomy, sexual abuse, promoting prostitution, and unthinkable, terrible crimes. By passing House Bill 2015, we'll give these victims some extra time for justice to take place where it had not before. Let's provide some extra protection for our kids. I ask for your support, and I ask that you take this bill and pass it forward with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Next, if I could have two witnesses come up, Stephanie Tuttle and Garrett Dow. Go ahead, whoever wants to start.
Good morning, Chairman Bacher, members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Tuttle. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a local prosecutor here in Marion County, and I've been prosecuting child abuse cases for over 7 years now. I'm here in support of House Bill 2015 on behalf of ODAA for several reasons. I just want to give you some of the practical sides of prosecuting these cases and why this is so important. Currently, the statute of limitations is 6 years when you're talking about a child that has been sexually abused. That statute of limitations will automatically start ticking once the child turns 18, no matter what. That means that if I have a 23-year-old come forward and talk about sexual abuse that she was that was put on her as a young child, I now have less than a year to start the prosecution. If she's 23 and a half, I now have less than 6 months. What happens in a lot of these cases, particularly when it's in the home, there's a lot of intimidation that goes on, either subtly or in the form of overt threats. And these kids need some time to get out of the house and mature and get on their feet and get on their own before they feel comfortable coming forward. One of the things that this bill would enable is for those kids to have a little more time to do that and enable us as prosecutors and the community to hold people responsible for what they've done. The second issue that's come up more recently is based on a case called Washington versus Crawford. And that case has severely limited our ability to prosecute cases where victims are unable to testify. It used to be that if I had a 3.5-year-old give disclosures and I had evidence that supported the fact that they had been abused, I would not have to use them as a witness. The evidence code would allow me to get in their statements without them actually coming on the stand. Unfortunately, that has now changed. In order for me to successfully prosecute a case like this, I have to call the child as a witness, and a 3.5-year-old just simply cannot do that. Absolutely not. So one of the things that we've been having to do in cases where we get disclosures from very young children is wait until they're older and more mature and able to testify. Now, currently we have 6 years to do it. I can tell you that having 12 years would be a benefit to the child and give them more time again to mature and have the internal strength and fortitude to go through the traumatic criminal justice process. And so for those reasons, as well as the ones mentioned by Senator Minnis, we are in support of this bill.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Garrett Dow, and as mentioned, I am a police officer for the City of Portland. Although the City of Portland hasn't had time to come up with a position on this bill, I don't represent the city today, but I do represent my kids and my community. I do have three kids, 5 years old, 3 years old, and 10 months old. And as a father, I have a particular interest in protecting their innocence. And it would hurt me to see them violated in any way and to see their abuser or any abuser of any child go unpunished because of a statute of limitations. As I was doing research on why it would be important to move the statute of limitations up, a lot of the information I found was anecdotal information about people that it's not until they are married and have trouble in their relationships that they seek to understand why, seek counseling and find out, and these repressed memories come forward and they determine that they were abused as children. A lot of people are married after the age of 24. But as I said, a lot of it was anecdotal until yesterday. I'm watching the news and I'm watching about a priest that was just convicted yesterday, Paul Shanley, on child abuse, child sex abuse of a Boston firefighter. And that Boston firefighter came forward when he was 24 years old, which if this had occurred in Oregon, he wouldn't be able to bring charges against his accuser because of the current statute of limitations. It's likely that that priest will receive life in prison now for those crimes. I think we have a responsibility as adults to protect our children, and this is a small but necessary step forward to accomplish that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Andrea Meyer and Kelly Skye.
Good morning. Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose House Bill 2015. We have a standing objection to any raising of the statute of limitations, but we're particularly concerned about the tinkering with this particular statute. I will preface my comments by saying that I've already testified on two other bills in Senate Judiciary Committee that also seek to amend this exact same statute. So the piecemeal approach could end up in doing away with the statute of limitations, and I would urge the committee to look into viewing all those bills together. I think it's important when we're talking about extending the statute of limitations to go back to the reasons why we have a statute of limitation, and there's a good purpose for it, and that is that innocent people are accused of crimes, and innocent people are convicted of crimes. We have a statute of limitation to encourage crimes to be prosecuted in a timely manner so that the defendant has an opportunity to defend himself. As many of you know, from being police officers and attorneys, evidence grows stale. Physical evidence disappears, witnesses' memories fade, and specifically where an offender does not know that they're a suspect in a particular incident, they have no reason to remember specific incidents or physical evidence themselves, or to start preparing their defense. In these child sex abuse cases, oftentimes there is no physical evidence, and it's the word of one person against the word of another. And so what is going on at the time of the accusations is very important. The longer time period we allow to pass before the accusations come to light and before we prosecute them, the less likely we are to know what is going on around the accuser at the time of the offense, or around the defendant, where they're working, who's talking to them, and where they could be being exposed to things that are then being reported. The example that Ms. Tuttle gave of a 3.5-year-old making accusations, you can, for anybody who has a 3.5-year-old, you can imagine that after 12 years of therapy talking about an incident, that it's going to be hard to really know what that 3.5-year-old thought or believed occurred to them back when they were 3.5 years old. Many of us don't have memories of what happened to us at 3.5 years old. The way that the statute of limitations is written now, it provides for different alternatives, whichever period tolls first. But under some circumstances, this could lead to prosecution of an incident, 25 years after the actual incident. How many people remember where they were 25 years ago at a given time? the other thing to remember about statute of limitations and the example that Ms. Tuttle gave is that the 23-year-old who comes forward with allegations for something that happened with for her when she was a teen, that gives the prosecution a year to present an indictment. The statute of limitations only places a limit on when an indictment is filed, and an indictment can be obtained rather quickly. It doesn't place a limit on when the trial actually occurs. So a case could go on pending after the statute of limitations, need only be filed before the statute of limitations. We would strongly urge you to use caution before extending the statute of limitations as to any crime, but specifically as to crimes where there's a large body of highly disputed evidence regarding repressed memory, suggestibility of child witnesses, and cases that are prosecuted on the word of one particular person alone. We oppose this bill, and we'd ask you to proceed with caution.
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and we too oppose House Bill 2015, and I think Ms. Skye has really well articulated the many reasons. This law was originally enacted in 1973 and has already been amended 10 times. In 1989, we had the expansion of 6 years for sex-related crimes, then an expansion in 1991 for the victim age, the particular section you're looking at. In 1997, an expansion in the first section of murder to attempted and conspiracy and other elements therein. Again, in 2001, with the DNA provision in section at the end of section 1. It's a piecemeal approach, which gives us much concern because it's incremental and it appears even innocuous in its incremental nature. But it is going up against sort of the fundamental considerations that Ms. Guy spoke about the ability of someone to adequately defend themselves, to know where they were, to bring alibi witnesses, to bring any other evidence forward. And in cases like this, that is extremely difficult. I note that not necessarily the furthest, but it could be 28 years between if a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, it would be 27 years, has memories of sexual assault of some nature and it was not reported. It could be 27, 28 years before the defendant is brought forward and must then somehow bring a defense forward. And it just seems to be an incremental assault on the justice system, and it's working in a manner that allows a defendant to actually reasonably defend themselves. So with all those reasons, we also join in opposition to this bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Representative Kirsten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, Ms. Guy, either one of you can weigh in on this. There was a suggestion made by one of the earlier witnesses that the prosecution that has just been going on in Massachusetts would have been precluded by statute of limitations here in Oregon. How does theirs or maybe or other states' statute of limitations on these kinds of offenses compare to what's in Oregon law now and what's proposed here?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I have to confess to not having done that research prior to coming, and I would be happy to do that. And just to make sure that I have your question clear, you would just like to know what the statute of limitations are on these type of sex crimes in other states?
Well, I wanted to get a sense about how Oregon's approach compares to other states. That is, are we shorter in terms of statute of limitations for these kinds of prosecutions or not? There was at least a suggestion made by an earlier witness that we were shorter than at least one other state, and I wanted to verify that.
Okay.
Representative McPherson, my understanding from speaking with Speaker Minnis's office is that this proposed legislation is modeled after the state of Pennsylvania and their statute of limitations. So there's at least one state that, to my understanding, has the longer statute of limitations already in place.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I too do not know what the statute of limitations looks like in other states, and I'm certainly happy to try to get at least some survey to give you a beat on where we lie in this. Obviously, this is based on one state, but there may be others that have not yet incrementally advanced as far as we appear to be going here.
just maybe this is more of a comment, but right now, as it stands, it sounds like, you know, taking into account the 3-year-old that we keep talking about, you still could possibly have an 18-year or whatever it ends up being. Doing my math here, quite a span of time. Has that been, in your experience, has this come up often?
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, you know, I am not in a position to tell you that because I only see the cases after they've been indicted, the cases that are actually successfully prosecuted. And I would say that I haven't seen too many that are at the far end of our current statute of limitations, but I think that someone from the DA's Association would have to tell you how many cases they are forced to decline because of a statute of limitations problem. And that does bring one more comment that I would like to make, and that is that in making law, especially in the criminal arena, there are always the one case that escapes the system for some particular reason, and if we model our criminal laws to apply to that one particular case, say the one particular 24-year-old who came in on their 24th birthday and their case was barred by the statute of limitations, what you risk doing is sweeping in people at the other end, and those are innocent people, and those are the people that the statute of limitations is designed to protect.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2015, and I would like to get, there seems to be some questions about some of the issues brought up, and some more information before we move to a work session on that one.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify, I'm happy to do that research. Are we just looking for sort of a state-by-state?
It would be helpful to know where we are and sort of the trend lines on this issue, I think.
Okay. Next, open a public hearing, House Bill 2297. Ms. Ward, do you want to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2297 is before the committee at the request of, it's here from the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill would take public indecency, which currently is a Class A misdemeanor, unless the individual committing the public indecency has either a prior public indecency or other sex offenses that are enumerated in the statute. If they have those priors, it makes public indecency a felony. This change would allow for similar out-of-state convictions to qualify as an underlying offense to elevate a public indecency to a Class C felony. Whenever there are situations where an out-of-state conviction is at issue, it is my understanding that the prosecution must prove that the underlying crime that would elevate this to a felony matches the elements of a similar statute in the state of Oregon. So, for example, if the state of Washington has a sex abuse 3 that is not the equivalent of a sex abuse 3 here in Oregon, it would not count as a prior conviction if the sex abuse 3 elements are not met here.
Thank you. Ms. Tuttle.
Members of the committee, again, I am Stephanie Tuttle with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and today speaking on behalf of House Bill 2297. What this does is recognize that when this was originally passed, it recognized that when you have a pattern of behavior and then commit the crime of public indecency, it should be elevated to a felony. It is more serious. All this does is allow us to elevate it in the same way if you have a conviction from another jurisdiction outside of Oregon, rather than only limit us to people that have committed their previous crimes here. So if someone comes here from Michigan after they've committed 10 crimes there, comes here and commits public indecency, this would enable us to prosecute that as a felony. It is true, we would have to prove that the elements are equivalent, and that is part of our burden of proof, as we always have the burden of proof, but at least this would allow us that opportunity.
Do you have any questions?
Okay, thank you.
And was there anybody else wanting to testify on that bill? Okay. Move 2297 into a work session. Entertain a motion.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill 2295 to full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Olson, you carry that for us. The next open a public hearing on House Bill 2299 and call Sergeant Duvall and Carmela Sugar.
Mr. Chair, again, this is a, if I could just add that I received from Legislative Fiscal a minimal expenditure impact statement on this as well yesterday afternoon. So if you could update your staff measure summaries to reflect minimal fiscal impact, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Duvall. I'm a sergeant here representing Oregon State Police. Again, with me is Diana Lindsay from the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit. House Bill 2299 is basically a housekeeping bill intended to provide a consistent process for sex offender registrants to forward certified copies of a court order that relieves them of their requirements to register to the Oregon State Police. Basically, under current statutes and ORS 181-600, 607, and 608, the criteria for relief is set forth in these statutes.
Put the microphone closer to that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Again, ORS 181-600, 607, and 608 provided the criteria and the process for offenders seeking relief from registration requirements. However, these statutes do not provide a consistent or a specific process for the successful adult petitioners to forward any relief ordered by the court to the Oregon State Police. The current statutes in 181-607 only provides a process for juvenile offenders to do so. The effects of this bill were that it would mandate both adult and juvenile offenders who have been granted relief by the court of their respective jurisdiction to forward certified copies of the court order to the Oregon State Police. This does a couple of things. One, it provides consistent language for all the parties involved and for both adult and juvenile offenders. It also provides clear language for all the parties, including the State Police and the Sex Offender Registration Unit, to facilitate the removal of these offenders from the Sex Offender Registration, the registry database, and relieve them of their mandatory registration requirements. There would be no fiscal impact to the agency. If there would, it would be minimal. And in closing, we do support this bill as a positive step for both the agency and for the registrants who may be given relief under this. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions? Can you give me an example of an adult that would have their have that lifted?
Yes, Chair Barker, we'd be glad to. The statute allows, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Lindsay, after a 10-year period, individuals who have been convicted of a sex offense that is a Class C felony or below are allowed by statute to seek relief from registration requirements through the court. And if that is so ordered, they are relieved from that obligation. The issue here becomes, how does the registrant officially notify the State Police, and what documents do the State Police accept to facilitate that removal?
Okay, thank
this,
you.
This bill addresses that.
Thank you. Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A question. It says when the court enters an order under this subsection, the person shall. Why don't you just have the court do it?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I don't know the answer to that question.
Seems to me that that would be much more efficient. It would always get done and need to talk about it.
Okay. Please, Ms. Sugar.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Kamala Sugar from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Again, we're here in support of this bill. I think I can answer Representative Krieger's question. Putting the burden on the sex offender to prove to Oregon State Police that the duty to report no longer exists, clears up what I often see in prosecution of failure to register cases as a lot of litigation pre-trial. Well, this order was entered, but I don't have a copy of it, and I can't prove it actually happened. And this kind of, well, we had a discussion on in court that this might be allowed. This way, the only way you get relief from registration is if you walk into the Oregon State Police with a certified court order. There isn't then all this anecdotal argument about whether you were or weren't relieved of this duty. And I think also, if you put the duty on the courts, you're going to attach a fiscal to the bill. Whereas if the duty is on the person who wants relief from registration, they just get a copy of that and they walk over to Oregon State Police and deliver it. So in some ways, it keeps the burden there. I also think this is already consistent with the juvenile statute, which requires the person who is relieved of juvenile registration to submit the court order to the Oregon State Police. So it makes sense that both the adult and the juvenile statutes match each other. And since we already have one that has that burden on the person being relieved, it should be the same. I wanted to touch on Section 3 of this bill, which addresses 181608. This also is helpful in subsection 8 of Section 3. What it does is it creates a standard or burden of proof in a juvenile hearing with regard to seeking relief from registration. Currently, there's no articulated standard of proof. That means when we go into court on a juvenile case, different judges in different counties could be applying a different standard of proof until the case gets through the appellate courts and gets us a standard of proof. It could be applied differently. So it just helps all of the courts and all of the attorneys to have that written into the statute. It's a simple housekeeping issue, but I just wanted to highlight that. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move from a public hearing to a work session. Representative Thatcher, would you like to make a motion?
Hi. Yeah, thank you, Chair. I move House Bill 2299 to full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Can you call the roll, please?
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Thatcher will carry that to the committee.
Okay.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. And once again, call Ms. Tunnel and Sergeant Duvall.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Tuttle with the Oregon District Attorneys Association here in support of House Bill 2300. The change that this makes to current law is that it requires a person who doesn't have a fixed address to register every 10 days. The current requirement is you have to register within 10 days of your birthday every year, and if you don't, it's a misdemeanor. You also have to register within 10 days of a change of address. If you don't, it's a misdemeanor if the underlying sex offense was a misdemeanor, but it is a felony if the underlying sex offense was a felony. The problem that this addresses is our homeless and transient population, and the difficulty when they come through my office is when they say, well, how can I register when I don't have a fixed address? And what we end up being put in the position is the only thing that we can really prosecute them for is failure to make the annual report, which, as I mentioned earlier, is always a misdemeanor. We can't prosecute them at the felony level. What this would do is require a person that doesn't have a fixed address, who's moving around or is staying in a non-traditional address, they have to come in every 10 days and make sure the state police knows where they are.
We should remember that the purpose of registration in the first place is not only to let the community know where these folks are, but also to let the state police know where sex offenders are residing in our communities. And if we don't have this, then with our transient community, they're the hardest ones to track down, they're the hardest ones to locate, and we really don't have the teeth, I guess, that we need to remedy the situation. And so this helps in that population.
Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question, Mr. Chair. Ms. Tuttle, I'm curious. I understand the homeless and transient population is a great problem because I've been there and I've seen that happen. But I'm a little confused on what specifically is a fixed address from what the statute's revealing here for 2300.
Chairman Barker, Representative Olson, it doesn't define what a fixed address is. I would say in my experience that what a fixed address is a place that you're actually living. Besides the homeless population, the other thing we have is the person that floats around from place to place. Well, I'm staying here for a few days, then I'm staying here for a few days. None of those are technically their fixed addresses. They're not, you know, they're not receiving mail there, those kind of things. So I would say a fixed address is where a person is, you know, residing for what they intend to be somewhat permanent, getting mail, getting services, and those kind of things, whereas other non-fixed addresses would all fit into this other category.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Sergeant Steve Duvall, here representing the Oregon State Police again, and again is Ms. Diana Lindsay with the Sex Offender Registration Unit. We are here to speak about House Bill 2300. At this point, we are going to be neutral on this bill. We support the concept behind the tracking of individuals without a fixed address that are sex offenders. However, we have some concerns about the language of the bill that we believe needs to be addressed. The history behind this issue has been around since registration of sex offenders began back in 1991 regarding persons that are homeless or without a fixed address. And Ms. Tuttle identified some of the issues that we have. Those include individuals who actually live in vehicles and move on a constant basis, those who register at missions or other support facilities for homeless that allow limited duration stays. And then there are even the issues of the homeless who live under bridges or on various streets and move constantly on a day-to-day basis. Currently in statutes regarding sex offender registration under 181.595 and other related statutes, they require a person obligated to register as a sex offender to register within 10 days of any change of residence, which brings in the problem of the homeless individuals. Essentially, they could change residences every day. Or every week, depending on their circumstances. One of the issues that we believe needs more discussion is the change of residence definition as it relates to homeless who are required to register as sex offenders. This question has been brought up numerous times since 1991, and our current advice to local agencies, the advice given by Ms. Lindsay and her co-workers in the Sex Offender Registration Unit to the agencies is that when this question arises for the local agencies, that they should register the person at the physical location where that person can be found, say, for example, during address verification or during a law enforcement sweep. If that location is an intersection, that's the address that's listed on the registration. For those registrants who are homeless and indicate that they move on a fairly regular basis, our advice and guidance to the agencies is that these individuals need to register within 10 days of any move. But that issue is not codified in statute, which is what this bill would address. Some of the effects of the passage of this bill, it would place into statute a requirement that sex offenders with no fixed address or homeless must register every 10 days. One of the issues that I'm sure will come up, but I'd like to mention, is that the intent here is not to treat homeless differently. The intent is to hold these individuals to the same standard that every other registrant is required to, which is to register within 10 days of an address change. For the state police, there would be a fiscal impact. If I can go through some of the numbers, we've estimated there's approximately 125 registered sex offenders who are homeless or have no fixed address at any given time. That number fluctuates as time progresses. But the effects of requiring 125 people to register every 10 days essentially results in a net increase of 4,500 registrations annually. That number of registration creates a workload issue for agencies that register offenders, such as the cities and the counties and the Oregon State Police field offices. But it also creates a workload issue for the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit. At our current staffing, Administrative Specialist 1, such as Ms. Lindsay, currently manage 16 to 1,800 cases or offenders as part of their caseload. That would essentially give us two additional positions to handle the additional 4,500 registrations. It would also require an office specialist one position, full-time equivalent, to handle the approximate 4,000 to 4,500 incoming messages that we receive at the Sex Offender Registration Unit. The bottom line on this bill is, although we support the concept, we remain neutral on this bill based on the concerns of the language. We do recognize that this issue is a continuing concern to law enforcement and the community as a whole, but we have concerns about the practical application of the process and the language that defines part of the process in the bill. We would ask that the committee consider additional input from law enforcement agencies and from the criminal justice community, such as the district attorneys. One suggestion that we talked about was perhaps changing the registration requirement to 30 days as opposed to 10. This entire process that's developed in this bill, when you come down to the bottom line, needs to be developed and balanced with the increase in the workloads and the available staffing that state police have and other agencies have, as well as the available revenue. This bill will most likely have an impact on cities and counties, and I believe there are some individuals here to provide testimony on that issue. That's all the information I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have a question. Sergeant Duvall. Are other states having the same problem with identifying the address, the location, that type of thing?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I believe I'm going to refer that to Ms. Lindsay.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Diana Lindsay with the Oregon State Police.
Thank you.
I do believe other states have similar problems to the transient and homeless situation, and I am aware of, I believe, at least California and Washington do have, I guess, more frequent reporting requirements for their transient and homeless people. I'm not sure exactly what the statutes are, but I believe I've come across some states who had like a 10-day reporting requirement, and I believe either Washington or California is a 30-day reporting requirement for transient and homeless.
Thank you.
Maybe you can just give me a little information here. If a person doesn't register within 10 days, what happens?
Chairman Barker, Representative Thatcher, the possibility at this point is that the state can prosecute them for failing to register. And if it's within 10 days of their change of address, it can be a felony if their underlying crime is a felony. Now, I'll be honest with you, given the resources in our local counties, prosecution of failure to register as a sex offender is not something that is typically done. I know in our county we reserve that for the people that we're most concerned about in the community, and the your usual offender, as long as they get themselves registered, we don't prosecute because of resource issues and issues of what, you know, should really happen in a given case. But it gives us the opportunity when you have somebody who is someone that we consider a dangerous predatory sex offender to have something to hold on them.
So with a homeless person maybe changing addresses every single day,
mm-hmm.
technically to be following the law, they'd be maybe registering every single day?
Chairman Bach, Representative Thatcher, yeah, the difficulty is with the statute as it is now is changing residence and what residence means, because what we're seeing is that people are saying, well, it's not really my residence, I'm not really living there, I'm just staying there briefly. And so we've had some difficulties in establishing that that's actually a residence for purposes of this statute. What they say is, I'm going to register as soon as I get settled in somewhere. Unfortunately, it just doesn't happen. So I guess the question is, would they technically be required to register every single day if they moved from day to day? I don't think that that's clear right now under the statute, because I think I would have a difficult time in court and have had a difficult time in court proving that that's a change of residence, as we commonly use that word. So what happens is they slip through the cracks, and there's really nothing that we can do.
You talked about a 30-day registration, so would that be, or even with the 10-day, are you talking about wherever they are every 10 days, wherever they are that day, they can register? So rather than, you know, moving around from place to place, having to register every single time they move? Is that what you're suggesting?
Chairman Bach, Representative Thatcher, that's exactly what we're asking, is that if they are really transient and moving from place to place, we feel that, you know, they're not going to move too far in 10 days. 30 days is better than every year, which is what it currently is. But every 10 days helps us kind of keep a tab as, are they in the same location? Are they moving around? Those kind of things. And so what we're asking is that if they really are the kind of person that doesn't have a fixed address and is bouncing around from place to place, at least every 10 days we have a good idea of where they are. And it may very well establish a pattern, you know, over several months, you know, if every 10 days of where they are likely to be.
Another question. What is required for registering? Is it something they mail in? Is it something, how burdensome is it?
Currently, the requirement is that they come down in person to the Oregon State Police. There's a form that they have to fill out. I believe they can also go to local law enforcement agencies. They can register with their probation officer or post-prison supervision officer as well. There's a one-page form that they fill out, which is, in effect, their name and their address. And then if earlier legislation that was discussed passed, it would also include where they're either going to school or teaching at a higher education institution. But right now it's name and address. But they do have to actually go in so you know who you're talking to. It's not just somebody pretending to be somebody else. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that many of these people have probably some mental problems on top of their other problems, and they're not responsible people, and they're not going to be complying, and the caseload they're talking about is going to increase. I would suggest you look very hard at the 30-day requirement and what that might do for us, because I think maybe that could come out of committee. I don't think the 10-day will.
Anything further? Thank you. Ms. Meyer, Ms. Skye, and Mr. Landauer, please.
Good morning again, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. We oppose this bill and have a number of concerns about it. Yeah. The state and communities have made it very difficult for folks who are required to register to transition and provide the necessary treatment so that they can find housing and work. And there are a few options in this area. And we've seen, if you've seen the TV news stories, it's when neighbors find out that there's someone registered, it's not how do you make it a safer community knowing that that person's living there, it's how you get rid of them, how you get them out of your neighborhood. This bill does not solve the problem. Homeless folks are most likely to fail at this. Earlier testimony said, well, we'll pick and choose when to charge someone with a felony. I predict you will see repetitive violations of this. I appreciate that Chair Krieger has already, or I assume your Chair Krieger also has also indicated the 10 days, but just to alert you, I mean, 10 days, among other problems, could be a Saturday or Sunday registration failure. If you require it to register on a Saturday or Sunday, it's not going to happen. the definition problem that was addressed in terms of the current law with the change of residence and adding fixed address, this doesn't solve the problem of some of the definitional issues regarding this law. This just adds one more terminology that's unclear, and I think Representative Thatcher, you were speaking to that earlier. The other point that I want to make is you do have folks who are moving all the time, who are camping out. You do have folks who have other issues going on, and they are simply not going to be able to comply with this. And this is just not the solution. The solution is for the state and our communities to provide more transitional homes and job opportunities so that folks are back up on their feet and are employed and do have residences in which they can then comply with the law, not by adding another violation element that will put them back into jail by failure to comply with this law. Thank you.
Questions? I have one. With especially just reading this morning's news about the cuts in domestic spending there, so it looks like there'll be less of that kind of housing available for people. What do you have any suggestions on how we might make something like this work? Some kind of registration so we know where people are, at least somewhat more than once a year.
Chair Barker, I don't have a particular language proposal. I think you need, one of the issues is to better identify residents. I think you've all identified that arguably someone who's homeless and who's moving from bridge to bridge, from transition from shelter to shelter, technically already falls under a registration it would be daily because it's within 10 days of the change of residence. If residence is where you're sleeping that night, then you are required within the 10 days every day. So one of the fixes needs to be to probably just clean this up so that it's understood by everyone what the requirements are. And the other is to not put such onerous requirements on someone that they should just go camp out at the state police or the local law enforcement to better able to comply with it. The solution, and I would be remiss if I didn't say, but there's a fiscal risk, and there's a fiscal impact, as was already discussed. There's an obligation our state has to ensure both safety of community and success of these individuals, and so the resources have to be there to make sure that they're not reoffending. That's one of the things we want as a community, is to make sure they've got the housing and the employment and the treatment necessary so that we are a safer community. And that's got to be a resource issue.
Thank you. Any other questions? Ms. Skye.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kelly Skye again, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'll start my comments by addressing your question, Chair Barker, and that is, what are the potential fixes? And I would suggest that it would be less expensive for the state of Oregon to put money into transitional housing for the population that we're talking about, instead of then prosecuting them and paying for the prison bed that will hold them merely because they couldn't make it into register because they couldn't find housing. That said, I want to highlight some of the problems that I think we're not talking about here, and that is there's a very low compliance rate with sex offender registration. I think if we look at the compliance rate and focus efforts on trying to increase the compliance, especially among the offenders who have serious offenses, serious sex crime convictions, that would be a better focus. Currently, sex offender registration laws require a large number of people to register, people that you may not realize, perhaps that were convicted of sex abuse 3. This can be the guy who grabs a woman in a bar. It's a touching over the clothes. May not be the kind of person that that the state of Oregon believes needs to register every 10 days for the rest of their life and needs to be prosecuted and continually use our resources on supervising them in the community. Similarly, rape in the third degree, which is what we call statutory rape, and that is a person who's under 16, say they're almost 16 and they have a consensual relationship with an immature 20-year-old, and that 20-year-old is guilty of a sex offense and is a lifetime registrant. These are the people that, some of the people that we're spending our resources on.
And, you know, I don't have the numbers of how many are actually considered predatory offenders, which are the people that, when the citizens of the state of Oregon talk about sex offenders, they're thinking of the predators. And so I think that when you're looking at where you're going to put your resources, you might want to look there at increasing the compliance on the offenders who are really serious and who we really want to track in the community. And other than that, I think that most of the issues I wanted to touch on have been touched on by the other people, and we would be happy to take part in a discussion of how to better address this problem. I will say that in my practice in Multnomah County, these cases are prosecuted. The people, sometimes referred to as couch surfers, you know, who move about, they stay with family, they don't have a fixed address. One of the problems there is that when you're a registered sex offender, you can't find housing. People don't want to rent to you, and they don't have to rent to you. So you can discriminate on the basis of sex offender registration. So unless you've got a family member or a friend who's willing to take you in where you don't have to be cleared to be on a lease, you're going to have a hard time finding housing. So, again, we are making these onerous restrictions on people who don't have a lot of options. And while a lot of people may not have sympathy for the people placed under those onerous restrictions, what we're doing is we're costing the system a lot of money to prosecute people who we could spend our resources supporting their success and making the community safer.
And you said a low compliance rate of registration. I'm not familiar with that. Could you tell us what is the rate or what?
You know, I don't. And okay. I, Chair Barker, I think that if you address that with the state police, that they could probably give you the actual figures, but my understanding is that it's relatively low.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Ms. Fire?
Well, I would, Mr. Chair, I'd be curious, then, Sergeant Ball's here, I'd be curious exactly what the rate is since he's here.
Well, we'll ask when we'll get through these and then ask him that. Mr. Landauer.
Good morning. I'm Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I've submitted some testimony which you have before you. I'll try to make this brief because most of the points have been touched upon. Our sexual assault detail would have liked to have appeared here today, but it goes to one of the points that I'd like to make. This bill has a resource issue impact for the City of Portland. Presently, the division takes reports from these individuals approximately 8 hours during a work week. That would be from 10 to 2 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The effect of this bill essentially would, at least as we read it, require us to have somebody available pretty much during working hours 7 days a week. As a result, we've estimated that this bill could have an impact on the Portland Police Bureau from approximately 1.5 full-time employees at a cost of roughly $80,000 to $120,000 a year. Presently, detectives take these reports from these individuals. We may have to do some staffing changes to try to reduce that cost, but that's certainly how it is done now, and I thought that we'd take numbers as to how we do it now. The other issue that I think Representative Olson hit on very nicely was, what is a fixed address? I took a brief look at the statute. I did not see that being defined in the statute. Does it mean a mailing address, a cross street, a P.O. box, a transitional facility, a social services agency? I don't know. But certainly one could say that if a fixed address included a P.O. box for an individual who does not have a residence, that person would only be obligated to register once a year. I don't know. So we'd like to certainly look at this bill more carefully, try to define what is meant by fixed address. I would like to make one more note. I don't want to continue on too far because you do have my written testimony. We did state, or I did state in my written testimony, that we would probably have an additional 3,000 to 4,000 reports on an annual basis. I'd like to amend that down to about 2,700. According to the state police, there are about 125 homeless individuals. That varies from day to day, I suppose. The number of homeless individuals under this act, probably are about 60% of them reside in the city of Portland. And so just doing the simple math, that's about 2,700 additional reports that the Portland Police Bureau would be required to take on an annual basis. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions if I'm
any questions. Okay, thank you. Sergeant Duvall, can you come back up to you and we can ask that question?
No, I don't.
And what the question was, what is the rate of compliance?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, we do have some statistics on that issue based on the numbers through December 2004. And again, I am not an expert on sex offender registration, hence I may refer to Ms. Lindsay.
That's right.
But overall, based on all the numbers that we have compiled, statewide there is an approximate 85% compliance rate among all sex offenders. Again, there are issues that we really cannot take into account, such as individuals who move two or three times without registering. And then do their annual registration. We obviously are not aware of those moves. But overall, based on the numbers we have, approximately 85%.
Thank you. Mr. McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sergeant Duvall, would one assume that the homeless population is at a very low level of compliance so that they're within the 15% that's non-compliant? Is that how it's breaking out now? Is it a situation, to put the question in other words, where we have a nominal requirement that just doesn't fit this population, so they're not complying now?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, that's a fairly difficult question to answer, and I don't have any factual information on that. It would be all based on experience and anecdotal. But it would be logical to assume a person who is, in essence, homeless would be somewhat less responsible in the area of registration than others. But to give you a direct answer to your question, I simply don't know, sir.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly not pro-sex offender in any way, I want to say that, but I'm just wondering how effective is this registration, 10 days versus 30 days versus a year? What tool does it give you, and how effective is it in keeping a short leash or whatever it is that you're hoping to do?
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, the intent is not to keep a short leash on these offenders. It is to merely ensure that they're complying with the registration requirements that are already in place for other offenders. Some of these folks who tend to move around quite a bit, we do tend to lose track of them. We're not able to respond effectively to community requests as to the location of certain offenders. Say, for example, someone requests a list of sex offenders in a certain zip code it goes by zip code, correct? That may not accurately reflect the sex offenders in that area because we have no documentation pertaining to persons who may be homeless in the area. You could certainly see in areas such as the city of Portland, city of Salem, perhaps Eugene, Springfield, where that may be a bigger issue than some of the more rural counties. The intent behind this bill, again, is to make sure that these folks who don't have a fixed address are complying with the law, and given the fact that they are moving so often, hence they must register every 10 days because we simply don't know what their place of living, where they lay their head, actually is. And as Ms. Tuttle pointed out, 10 days is a number based on the fact that these people do move and that they are required to register within 10 days of moving. However, reasonably and logically, 30 days would probably be better. But again, I'd like to point out that state police would like a little more discussion with the committee, with our law enforcement partners that have issues with this bill. There are a lot of things that need to be worked out and further clarified.
Okay.
one more question.
One more question.
Maybe this doesn't relate specifically to this bill, but maybe just the overall law in general. Is there a differentiation between predatory sex offenders having to register and just the normal catch-all, everybody that's been prosecuted as a sex offender?
I believe I'm going to refer that one to Ms. Lindsay. Predatory designation is different in a sense, but I think she would be much better qualified to answer that question than I would.
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, I'm Diana Lindsay with the Oregon State Police. The predatory designation is one that is given to those offenders who are considered to be a greater risk to the community. However, the registration requirements themselves, which I believe was your question, are identical. For anyone who is required to register, the requirements are all the same. The only difference is that on a predatory sex offender, law enforcement is allowed to do proactive community notification and actually let people know these people are living in their community. For a regular sex offender, as we call them, we can only give out information upon request from someone in the community. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2300. It's obvious this has a lot of, it's not ready to go to work session, so there's a lot of things. And one of the most, to me, one of the important things, maybe not the most important, but is the definition of what that address is so that the courts and so on know what they're dealing with, so they'd be able to comply with the law. And also the high cost of a 10-day registration seems like it would be prohibitive. So I hope the parties can take a look at that and maybe come up with something workable. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2301. And once again, Ms. Sugar and Ms. Sergeant Duvall and Ms. Lindsay. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Sergeant Steve Duvall, still with the Oregon State Police, here to represent the agency along with Ms. Diane Lindsay from the Sex Offender Registration Unit. And we're here to provide information on House Bill 2301. The intent behind this bill is to create a process that would allow certain sex offenders to complete their annual registration by mail as opposed to reporting in person as currently required by statute. The idea of this came through a March 2004 meeting with the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee, and has been processed since that date. Some of the history behind this is that since registration began in 1991 in the state of Oregon, we currently have approximately 1,200 registered sex offenders in the sex offender registry database that are required to annually register. Offenders are required to register upon release from prison or jail or when they're placed on probation. They are required to annually register within 10 days of their birthday or within 10 days of a change of address. To give you some numbers, basically the 2004 initial registrations that we completed statewide was about 1,635. The 2004 change of address registrations we completed was about 9,768. And then the annual registrations the annual registrations that are required within 10 days of birthday for 2004 was approximately 8,594. And this 8,594 is the number that this bill addresses. The current law requires that all of these registrations, the initial, the change of address, and the annual, all be completed in person with either a local law enforcement agency, supervising agency for persons on parole or probation, or the Oregon State Police. The process that's being put forth in this bill sets up an idea that a mail-in registration card is sent to the registrants who need to complete their annual registration, assuming they haven't moved. Basically, the Oregon State Police already sends an invoice for the $70 registration fee that is required to be paid by some of these individuals to the last known address. The thought is that this card could be simply inserted in there, resulting in a very minimal impact financially for the agency. Basically, the bill sets forth the idea that an address verification card would be developed where the registrant would essentially only be required to sign the card and then return the card to the Oregon State Police, satisfying their registration requirements. The way the bill currently sits, the process would be optional for the registrant. The registrant could still opt to go to a local law enforcement agency or to a state police agency and register in person if they did not wish to do this by mail. Although we support the concept behind this, there are, again, as with the last bill, some problems with the language, and we have some concerns about the bill that we think need to be developed and pursued. On the side of benefits, it would include a time saving for law enforcement and for OSP field offices in that some of this 8,594 annual registrations would not physically have to come in and register in person. One of the problems that we have noticed with this is that of that 8,594, approximately 4,700 actually, I believe 4,780 registrants of this number go on supervision or remain on supervision. The problem with that is the registration fee is not billed to registrants who are on supervision pursuant to statute. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Therefore, we would not be sending an invoice to those people. So essentially, for half of this group, OSP would have to develop a mailing process to mail an annual registration card to these people separate from the invoice. That issue isn't addressed in the bill. Another one of the benefits, having to mail this separately would result in a potential impact to the OSP sex offender registration unit as far as the actual mailing and the mailing cost. These could result in a possible workload issue and what we believe at this point to be minimal fiscal impact on the mailing cost. But one of the larger problems we have with the bill is that the bill is vague and needs clarification on several issues, some of which include what would be the criteria that would establish a failure to report under a mail-in system. We believe that would need to be further clarified and defined. Some of the questions that arise are when and how will the Oregon State Police mail these address verification cards, and how are the cards to be returned? Are the cards sent via first-class U.S. postal, or are they sent return receipt required? How are the offenders to return these cards? What time frame should these cards be returned in? All of this information should be specified in the bill. The way the bill is currently crafted, it would result in a lot of difficulty in pursuing prosecutions for failure to register under this process. One of the other issues that we came across was a current statute that requires registration directs law enforcement to photograph each of these individuals during their registrations. The statute says shall photograph during each registration. That's a conflict with this bill, and it's not addressed in the bill. The potential workload relief or any fiscal savings that might result in the field is a positive benefit to this bill. However, there would be no actual relief for the State Police Sex Offender Unit, Ms. Lindsay's unit, because even though the registrations are being mailed and that step of going in person and registering is bypassed, the registration process still has to be completed on the database entry side. In closing, the State Police request an opportunity to work with the Legislative Council to craft language that satisfies the legal requirements and to further develop this concept of alternate annual registrations. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have now.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I've got a few questions, yes. Sergeant Duvall, I'm curious, what is the current rate of return for your invoice payment right now?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, again, I refer to Ms. Lindsay on that question. And I don't know that we'll be able to give you a solid answer yet.
I've always been interested in that.
Please.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, are you meaning the return rate of the envelopes themselves that we send the invoices out in?
Yes.
Where we apparently do not have the correct information for the offender's address?
That's correct.
I would say that we probably receive approximately 100 invoices back each month, and we bill the offenders the month following their birthday. So if we have approximately 12,000 offenders out there, we're billing approximately 1,000 a month, and I would say we receive approximately 100 back. That can be due to perhaps they have no mail receptacle and they've neglected to give us a mailing address, or in fact many are returned with moved written across the front of the envelope.
Okay. Thank you. I have an additional question. It deals with what Washington State is doing right now with their registration, mailing process. How long have they been doing that for? Do you have any idea?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, being new to this, I am not familiar with Washington's process.
Okay, because then my next question was just, you know, if you were aware of any of their successes to their program. I was just curious.
Okay. Sure.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Kamala Sugar from the Lane County District Attorney's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. The association reviewed this bill, and we have serious concerns about enforcement. My primary point on that matter is that it doesn't specify a mail in registration card as outlined by Sergeant Duvall, but instead simply says an alternate reporting method other than in person. One of the points is that a person who is required to register as a sex offender can register the Oregon State Police, the local county sheriff's office, or the municipal police department. That can include any municipality that has a police department in the whole state. And they could each have different authorized reporting methods other than by in person, which could include a telephone call by their grandmother to say, yeah, he's still here living with me. So my concern is, how would any prosecutor who receives information that they have not reported know whether they had reported other than in person and whether it was authorized by some municipality somewhere? So while we aren't completely opposed to some sort of reworking of the reporting requirements so that it can be more cost-effective, it needs to be standardized throughout the state, and that's just a huge concern to us. Touching on a few of the other points, it also requires, the current statute requires reporting within 10 days of one's birthday. Does that mean that the state police or whatever agency has to receive it within 10 days, or does it mean that that it has to be postmarked within 10 days? So those are other concerns regarding specifics in terms of enforcement. You can't believe the pretrial motions and litigation we're going to face if we don't narrow these down before we have a new law that changes this. I also am concerned about the verification of the identity of the person who's submitting a registration other than in person. As was earlier testified, currently a photograph is taken to confirm that person's identity along with their actual signature. Short of a fingerprint on the card or something like that, I don't know how we would do that with a mail-in registration. So we're willing to work with whoever the proponent is of this bill that wants to make it happen, but I think there are a lot of concerns. Last thing I want to point out is almost any time that I have a case, and in our county we do prosecute these pretty regularly, when I have a case, I take it to trial and I'm proving a person has failed to register. I bring in the forms that they sign at the time of their conviction that are attached to the judgment of conviction, that they agree they have to register, and it outlines the methods and the requirements of registration. I submit them because they've signed them, and we have proof that they had notice. If we change those reporting requirements and that notice isn't included, it makes it more difficult for us as well. So I think a new form of notice is going to be required to each of those individuals so we can have proof that they were aware of the requirement. Those forms are used also at the time of release from incarceration, release from probation, or post-prison supervision. So those are my concerns, and again, we're not adverse to working on this bill.
Great. Thank you. Any questions?
Well, maybe just one.
Okay.
It kind of all sounds like, forgive me, I'm not all familiar with this registration process, but sitting here listening to this, it seems like a lot of bureaucratic paper shuffling to me, and I'm just wondering, is the public safer as a result? And just speaking maybe again to the whole law, and is there any proof or correlating evidence that this registration, whatever method is used, is keeping the public safer? Just curious.
Chair Barker and Representative Thatcher, I think it would be helpful for Ms. Lindsay to talk about the different levels of notice that are given to different organizations and agencies, either at the request of the public or, in the case of predatory sex offenders, affirmatively. But from my experience, it is helpful to in several points. Registration, as a general rule, allows the public to be informed about the location of sex offenders who are convicted. While, of course, there's been testimony on other bills this morning that there are sometimes more serious and less serious offenders who are caught into this requirement, overall, the risk of reoffending is still there, and it's still helpful to have the information. In most cases, other than the predatory offenders, it's available upon request. So if someone decides they want to open a daycare in their neighborhood, they want to know about their neighbors so they can make decisions about whether to take the kids on a group walk to the park or not. It's something they can request. It's also when there's a person on parole or post-prison supervision, there's that added, information given to people in the neighborhood if they're a predatory offender, then the probation officer gives that, but I can be corrected. and I would also just say that, as I said in the institutions of higher education bill that we talked about earlier, the offenders who are predatory tend to gravitate toward dangerous situations, so they tend to choose a home near a daycare, or choose a home near a park where young children play, or choose to work as a volunteer with children in a school, in an institution of higher education, or even just in some sort of a neighborhood organization. So having that added information available, I think, makes everyone safer.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, if I may add, I agree with Ms. Sugar and don't necessarily see this as an enhancement to public safety. I believe this bill was more put forth to streamline the registration process for both the offender and for the registering agencies, both local law enforcement and state police. If I can digress for just a moment, I would like to reiterate some of the testimony that we just heard about the specifics of this bill, and I've submitted written testimony on this, and it's included, but I'd like to point out that some of the problems with this bill is that it allows an agency to authorize an alternative method of reporting, such as the mail-in verification card, but it really doesn't clarify which agency is to develop this process, nor does it specify the method that's to be used. The question comes up, does the state police create a process that's used statewide, or does every agency across the state of Oregon create their own process? These are some of the issues that we would like further discussion with the ODAA and local law enforcement agencies.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2301, and we will not go to work session on it. Obviously, it needs a lot of work in fairness to the police and the prosecutors, as well as the people who are registering the registered sex offenders. They have to know what they need to do so they're in compliance. I mean, we can't very well start charging them when they don't, when we can't figure out what it says. No further business. The Committee on Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Law is adjourned.